Welcome back, everybody. Time again for another Word Balloon podcast. This is John Suntress. Great conversation today. We got Rick Remender talking about 7 to Eternity, but a lot of his other books as well. Rick, of course, we've known him for a long time, going back to Last Christmas, and certainly books like Fear Agent and Nightmare and Sea of Red. And we spent a little time reminiscing because it's been 11 years since I started talking to Rick Remender. And I'm really excited about these new projects like 7 to Eternity, his new book with Jerome Pena. But we also talk about Low and Deadly Class and so many of the other books. And I really feel like Rick, given his time at Marvel Comics, is one of those great creators who did his time at the Big Two and is very content now to do his own thing, and has successfully brought his audience from his Marvel books to the new experiences, and is reaping the benefits from it. Has top-notch artists that he constantly works with, and is doing fresh original concepts like the books that I've already mentioned. This is a great chance to talk to a guy who understands the market and makes it work for him as a creator-owned guy. So it's a pleasure to talk to Rick and get his point of view on his books and the current comic market, the continuing discussion that we have here on Word Balloon. It's all brought to you by the League of Word Balloon listeners. Thank you, League, for your support via subscriptions to Patreon. It's not necessary, but it helps pay for the equipment, get me to conventions, make connections, and bring you fresh new artists and writers and other pop culture people to Word Balloon each week. It's been a hell of a September, and a lot of it has to do with the thanks to the League of Word Balloon listeners who help keep the lights on. Word Balloon is free, but if you want to help the cause and think what I do here is, worth you contributing, even a dollar a month is greatly appreciated, or even the price of a comic book, say $3, when you consider the hours of entertainment that me and the guests try to provide each episode here at Word Balloon. If you're interested in subscribing to Word Balloon, go to wordballoon.com. You can click on the Patreon ad. That will take you to patreon.com and my Word Balloon page there. If you can spare the money, I certainly do appreciate it. And we've got new subscribers that have just joined this month. And as a thank you, I'm trying to provide episodes and interviews first to Patreon subscribers. They'll eventually wind up on the feed. But case in point, Cincy Comic-Con, really 5 great hours of panel discussions with the 100 Bullets team, a great solo Brian Azzarello conversation, a great Marty Pascoe conversation, a great group of creator-owned comic creators talking about creator-owned comic creators. How you doing, everybody? Talking about their views and how they get their works out to the market. And we're talking about really smart people like Ryan Brown, Jim Rugg, and Sarah Dyer, and, like I said, Marty Pascoe and Brian Azzarello, Dave Johnson, Eduardo Risso, Dennis Hopeless, Jason Latour. Very fun conversations at Cincy Comic-Con. The Word Balloon Patreon subscribers will be getting them first. But thank you very much for that support, League of Word Balloon listeners. And I've already started. I've got Marty Pascoe posted as we're speaking, and more panels coming up before the end of the month. Word Balloon is also brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where there are great deals happening right now at InStock Trades. Things like the Doctor Strange Omnibus with an Alex Ross cover. What a great idea, and what a great deal. It's 50% off. It's just $37.50. Great run of Doctor Strange in that omnibus. You can get the Captain America Epic Collection, including the works of Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, also representing things like the first appearance of the Falcon, Jim Steranko's amazing run, also Gene Colan early on doing incredible work on Cap and the Falcon. 50% off, it's just $19.99. You can also get Fables Deluxe Edition, the hardcover volume 13, with Bill Willingham and Mark Buckingham doing what they did best. That incredible run is collected in hardcovers now. 50% off, $14.99. You can also get Velvet, Volume 3, The Man Who Sold the World, Ed Brubaker, Steve Epting. What a tremendous series this is. And great to finally get Volume 3. 42% off, $8.69. You know something, as we close, I'm going to give you some great deals on some Rick Remender books at the end of the show. So listen for those deals, or while you're listening to this interview, go over to InStockTrades.com and check out the great deals and great prices waiting for you. InStockTrades.com. All right, without further ado, let us begin our conversation with Rick Remender. It's happy to welcome him back, and it's always fun. And, you know, Rick is one of those guys, kind of like a Matt Fraction, that, I don't know, the guy always makes me laugh. And not just with his concepts, but really just our conversation. So it was really great a couple weeks ago to finally catch up with Rick and see what's going on. Here's Rick Remender now on Word Balloon. Despite technology conspiring against us, we've managed to make a connection, and I'm talking down the lane to Rick Remender. Hi, Rick.
What's happening, John?
Welcome back.
Well, how many years has it been now?
We're closing in on a year. Now, we did do Cincy Comic Con.
Oh, yes.
And I do count that.
I count it as well.
All right, good deal. And honestly, you did reach out in January, and I'm like, yes, but we never did firm up a date, so I do apologize. But I'm here.
We flirted with it.
Yeah, exactly. But I miss you. And seriously, man, you're kicking ass, and I'm very proud of you because I knew you when.
Way back.
Kind
when.
Of.
When I was a whippersnapper, when I was
it's
a
true.
Man full of hopes and dreams, and I had a posture and vigor.
And we'd talk about, you know, Sea of Red and Nightmare and Fear Agent. And
going back 11 years, John, talking about
I know,
11
man.
Years.
I know. So, well,
we're not getting any younger.
Well, that's the thing, man. No, you were doing that stuff, and I was just getting started with Word Balloon and Last Christmas, and Fear Agent tickled me, and you know, here we are. And seriously, you are the man of high concepts, honestly, and such varied concepts. Great sci-fi, Deadly Class is crazy shit on its own.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really, you know, low is literally up and down, no pun intended. And I don't mean that in a critical way. I mean that in terms of what you're doing with those poor characters as they rise to the surface.
Yeah, it's not easy. It's not easy.
But and Black Science, man. Crazy Lost in Space mixed with Fear Agent.
Yeah, yeah. With a little sliders sprinkled in there and a little...
I'll take that.
Yeah, you know, all the little quantum leap on top and then dip it into a Mobius milkshake.
Huh. See, now I'm into all those references. I was telling Ricky, trying to get my technology together, was like Flight of the Phoenix, Jimmy Stewart movie. And I got the... yeah, okay, John. I don't know. I don't know that movie. But that's okay.
I'm a Philistine.
No, you're not a Philistine. You're a product of your era. God bless you, son. It's all good. You just threw out a bunch of great
references. If I am nothing else, I am a product of my era.
But yeah.
I basically, yeah, I am. I couldn't be more stuck in the 80s. There's
no, you're not stuck. Well, I guess in Deadly Class's case, but
yeah.
But it's fun. I mean, it comes out good and everything. Do you want to? I want to start with the new book. 7 to Eternity.
Yes, yes. Reteaming with the beast who is known as Jerome Pena.
Man, wonderful Fear Agent work. Wonderful, uncanny X, whatever the fuck it was. X-Force?
It was X-Force, yes, that's right.
See? I'm not good with my X-Men, but, you know, again, you guys deliver.
So,
I'm not.
How dare you, John?
I know, dude. Seriously, I am. I'm embarrassed because honestly, they always get great writers and artists for the X-Men books. And I'm just, you know.
It's not your thing.
It isn't my thing, but I truly did. I read, you know, I read a good, you know, almost two dozen of Uncanny X-Force. I forget how long it went. Only about 24 issues or so.
It was I think we went at 34 was the.
34? Okay.
Yeah, which, given the way that all the reboots happen, was a pretty spectacularly long run. Given how things go these days.
You know, honestly, Rick, if you don't mind real fast, because it's kind of a hot topic right now, the cancellation of Nighthawk from Dave Walker, and great book. But you've faced that kind of immediate cancelization. Dr. Voodoo, loved Dr. Voodoo, dude. I was one of the, you know, however many thousand were buying the thing. What can you tell us as someone who's kind of gone through that? I find it interesting. The response has been from people we know like Brian Bendis, well, you got to pre-order. And I remember you saying that about Dr. Voodoo back in the day.
Sure. Well, you know, what's interesting is back in the day, Dr. Voodoo's numbers would be considered, you know, a mid-level hit right now.
There you go.
This was back in 2008?
Eight or nine, I think, yeah.
when he was the Sorcerer Supreme.
And I had turned him into the Sorcerer Supreme in my first Marvel work, which was an issue of What If, called What If the Age of Apocalypse. And in that, I liked the idea that Brother Voodoo, who always intrigued me, you know, that Jericho Drum became Sorcerer Supreme. And so I did it in this. And then when I learned that they were going to be doing it in the actual 616, I pitched on it, and Tom liked it. And man, I couldn't have been more excited. I wrote 20 issues of outline for that thing that unfortunately we didn't get to. But, you know, I mean, it's the hard realities of the way the industry is. Not everything is going to stick. And did it hurt? Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I wish that we had been able to, if they had given it 10, 15 issues, who knows? But back then it was anything under 20 pretty much got cut at the neck.
Sure.
And now you look, you know, and Marvel and DC both have plenty of comics under 20. But once you're under 20, you're pretty the traditional thinking is you're on your way to the bad zone. And, you know, look, it comes down to numbers. I don't think it comes down to a lack of desire. I think that, you know, I know Axel really well, and I know what he wants is a diverse line of comic books that have a lot of different ideas and is representative not just in the comics but in the human beings that make the comics. And you know, David's got all kinds of stuff going on there. So
absolutely,
you know, you win some, you lose some. I won some, I lost some. You know, that's Marvel. The fans are fickle. You know, speaking of Voodoo, Voodoo is a hit book. You know, you cannot predict it, nor can you guarantee it.
I'm hip, and that's, I think, the thing that needs to be remembered. And also, like you said, they cancel Dr. Voodoo, but then, you know, you find a hit with Uncanny X-Force, and granted, it only went, 34 issues, but like you said, I mean, for a Marvel run, that's pretty good in these days, with all the reboots.
34 was, I mean, by that point, I was moving on to Uncanny Avengers and Cap and just
right?
The band.
Yes.
Anyway, but the I've always been I was talking to Robert Kirkman and Brubaker about this the other day, and I sell way more trades than singles. I always have. I think maybe I do write for trades, so maybe my fans kind of clued into that. So the trade numbers on Uncanny X-Force were just, you know, phenomenal. So there was this you know, groundswell. It was a huge hit for us. But I think that the Dr. Voodoo could have been the same had I been able to get it to issue 10-15. But unfortunately, business affairs on that, you know, they've got a cutoff point where they have to shut these things down. And that's the difference between a Marvel or a creator owned. You know, the kind of numbers that they were selling on that to shut it down. You know, we can do that on a creator owned book and live happily, and then sell a truckload of trades, which is interesting because, you know, Image has sort of become Vertigo, how Vertigo was in the 90s, where you just, you know, everybody was selling 15,000 copies of their comics, but then they'd talk to you about, like, oh my God, it's all about the trade paperbacks.
Yep.
And now that's Image. The trade numbers are, you know, ridiculous. But anyway, yeah, so.
No, that's great, man. Honestly. And you're cool with the price points and everything that, you know, Image lays out, first trade $9.99 and the rest of, you know, $14.99.
We were one of the first trades to do it back in the day with Sea of Red, and it worked out real well on that book. I've always thought it was a smart business move. Look, I mean, I'm up against a guy coming into a shop who has to choose between Deadly Class or an X-Men book or whatever the hell else, you know, is stand around it. So we're up against, if you can get them in and you got a quality product, then you're golden. And the getting them in, that's what the price point is there for. It's to say, hey, and in our case, on most all of these trades, we've packed them full of 6-7 issues worth of content for $10.
Yep. Yep.
And the idea is like, look, we're losing money here for sure. Like Deadly Class, I think it's 160 something pages of comic book. For
wow, the first trade, that's fantastic.
For $9.99, but you know, it's this is a cutthroat thing, and you're really hoping to hook people. And it worked. You know, the trade numbers they've just been phenomenal. We just got the hardcover numbers in today, and that thing is selling gangbusters.
Nice.
And I think that that's all in. I think that all builds. I don't think it builds out of the singles, and I could be wrong. I think it builds out of those $9.99 trades.
I think you're right, man. No, I really do, and I think it's like you say. It's been happening long enough now, and with enough great creators doing these amazing books, that no, there's enough of the retailer audience gets it. I don't know, you know, you get the bookstore numbers, and I imagine it, you know, sells equally as well. And that's the great news is now you've got strength in Amazon and the various, you know, whatever's left of the book chains beyond Barnes and Noble and Books a Million or wherever your books land.
There's actually outside of Amazon, there's still some real big numbers moving. I think that
good.
I think that people want their books and people want their vinyl and people want like. We all digital, yeah. And then we spent a few years with it and realized it's not the same. You know, I got rid of my LPs and my CDs, and I went totally digital. I got rid of my DVD collection, and man, I wish I didn't. I like tactile things. I like a library of my music and my comics, and I think people are doing that because the numbers that I'm seeing, like. Tokyo Ghost Volume 2, we just got our numbers, and
okay.
They're crazy. It's a crazy world now. So you're selling, you know, 8,000 copies to comic book stores, which back in the day, you know, you would have been, I don't even know how to process what that would have been like, but you're also selling 8,000 to the Amazon and the bookstores and the book market. And that's not
fantastic.
Even including digital, which is its own beast entirely.
That's excellent, man. Well, and also you're really smart because beyond the trades and the hardcovers, then you get into the deluxe hardcovers and the omnibuses and, you know, you know what you're doing. And it's, how do you sense that? Like when, I mean, obviously you've done it for, you know, certain books and everything. And I don't know, is that the plan for all the books or do you really kind of look at your audience and, or even canvas your audience and say, who wants this?
I'm very fortunate in that I work with artists that deserve that prestige format. And so I think that what I've always looked at is, you know, all of my horror work from 2004, 5, and 6, and 7 was collected in a giant hardcover, the Crawl Space hardcover.
Mm-hmm.
Strange Girl, we did a hardcover, and it sold out. And then we did a soft cover, and it's almost sold out, so maybe we'll do an oversized hardcover next. We did one for Last Days of American Crime. Deadly Class, Black Science, Fear Agent. I think that really it comes down to the books that are selling, which at this point in time, because of the wonderful resurgence and interest in creator-owned comics, is all of them. That we can, you know, like Deadly Class, we printed, I think, 6,000 of those oversized hardcovers, and it's been a month, and we've sold half the print run.
Nice.
So there's, and, you know, the thinking now is also that there's a different market for that stuff. That the people buying those oversized hardcovers are an entirely different audience than the people buying the trades, than the people buying the singles. The thinking is now that we've got three different subsets of audiences of people. So I don't know if that's right or not, but that's the sort of traditional thinking.
Do you think, that's the thing, you've been doing this for 11 years or... This is like the real stuff that you consider like, you know, okay, this is when I knew what I was doing.
Well, I started making comics in 97 with Captain Dingleberry.
Okay.
And then that went to Slave.
I always forget that. Go on.
Yeah. My love letter to Frank Zappa. And then that wrapped. And then at that, we went to Slave Labor Graphics. And then I did Blackheart Billy and Dawn Creature, and
yes.
Then I went back off and, you know, started inking the Avengers and penciling Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and penciling that Bruce Campbell book and penciling Last Christmas. Well, you know, so it was jumping all around. You know, we did an oversized hardcover for Last Christmas last year.
Yeah, I saw that. Absolutely.
And so most of these things we're putting in that format, and they're selling to whole new groups of people. You know, it's a dream come true. So in terms of when I started doing creative work in 97, and now, you know, almost 20, Jesus, that's 20 years, isn't it?
There you go. Nice.
Old Man Rivers.
It's true. It's no, it's good, man. And this is this was the dream. I mean, that's the thing. You are the model of, I think, the new path in terms of doing your own thing, doing it well enough that you graduate to, you know, you had a couple DC books, but, you know, DC and Marvel, and certainly made your big splash in Marvel, and now get to take your audience with you and continue to succeed. I mean, that's the new path now.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that what's interesting is there's a lot of people who are finding that finding success with the creator on without going to Marvel or DC. There's whole new swaths of human beings that have come in, male and female now. And, you know, it's a collection from, you know, people from The Walking Dead to the Marvel films to this pop culture phenomenon that doesn't seem to be, you know, slowing down. You know, look at the cons now versus how they were 10 years ago. You know, it's an incredibly varied group of people as opposed to, you know, 10, 12 years ago, it wasn't.
True.
And I think that it's just getting bigger. You know, maybe that's just hopeful thinking.
No, I think you're right, though. I really do. And I think especially pointing out, too, that, yeah, you don't need DC or Marvel to necessarily be part of the path. And there is this new audience, too, that's coming in. And I always say this now with the current DC and Marvel people, where it's like, yeah, the 20-something that's walking in, they could give two shits about what Spider-Man did during the Clone Saga. They don't care. They're here because, like you said, Walking Dead or some of these other, or they came into a con with Walking Dead, found some other, you know, things that they liked either on Artist Alley or at a publisher's, you know, table or something like that. And we are really looking at a new audience that the big two don't matter.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that they're always going to be an entry point, and you're always going to have kids gravitating sure. towards those recognizable characters. But now we've got such a vibrant and healthy next step, you know, for when you hit 19 and maybe the superhero books aren't tickling you as they once were, you know, maybe as they're not intended to. That there's just a wealth of material now that you can that yep. you can graduate into, and or still do both. You know, there's plenty of great work being done at Marvel and DC as well.
Absolutely,
I mean, it really is. It's a golden age. It really is.
It's crazy because I really, you know, I was excited when you guys were starting to happen 10 or 11 years ago, and I'm like, oh, isn't this great? Look at the amount of variety in genres and stories and you know points of view. And now even more so. I mean, it's 100-fold from where we were 10 years ago. It really is.
It really is.
Because
yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. No, you're right. You're right. It's a vertigo world, but it's, you know, now it's an image world. So it's very interesting. And are you at all, I mean, I don't know what kind of relationship or if they've even approached you. Aftershock seems to be a new imprint that's certainly getting a lot of attention and I think honestly putting out a good product as well. And I don't know if you've been interested in that at all.
Yeah, I mean, Mike extended a hand, and you know, the thing for me at this point is, Image, you know, was my home from 2004 until 2009, 10, you know, or 2008 when we moved
to Dark Horse.
Fear Engine to Dark Horse, and I worked there for a little while, and coming back to Image in 2012 when I did, or 13, I can't remember, but whatever.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah,
it's been a nice homecoming, you know.
Cool.
I've always believed in Stevenson, and to see what he's done and the tenacity that he's exhibited, and the success of what they've grown here. You know, I'm in a position where I'm able to literally sit, in my house and write anything I want. And team up with great artists, and we share ownership 50-50, and we bring in great colorists, and I've got my editor, Sebastian Gerner, and I've got, you know, Image is this wonderful infrastructure where it's a dream come true. I'm able to provide for my family and do what I was doing 20 years ago. The thing I quit 20th Century Fox to try and do is now reality. Yeah. And I don't want to give all the credit to Stevenson, I have to give a lot of it to him. I think that he's a smart guy, and he really stuck to it and fought this thing out because he's so passionate about it. And it opened up a lot of opportunities for every single creator in comic books.
That's cool. And would you say that beyond the loyalty and again, the fact that he is willing to accept your ideas pretty readily and stuff, is it the best deal for you, you know, in terms of financially and stuff, to stick where you're at rather than doing something for somebody else?
I've worked for almost every other company.
Yeah.
And there's not a deal that comes within a mile of Image. And look, I mean, it comes down to this. I'm not in – I have no – like, this is going to sound completely cheese dick, but my employers are my audience. And as long as people are buying the book, then Image takes a percentage of that, which is a very fair percentage for what they provide, and the rest of it comes to us.
Yep.
That's it. And so if I've got an audience and those people want to buy my books and they're enjoying them, and we work very hard to try to provide, you know, quality comical books – then it's unfiltered. Image is basically direct access to my audience. And as long as I have that audience, those are my employers. And
I'm with you.
And Image provides that in a way that, as somebody who's, you know, fairly anti-authoritarian and doesn't, it works well for my personality type.
I understand. Yeah, you know, I heard an interview you did earlier this year about Low, and you kind of mentioned that, you know, you were kind of in a depressed state and everything. How you doing?
I'm great now. When I started Low, I mean, that's the crazy thing about comic books is by the time you get enough material out where people could sit down and like binge three trade paperbacks, they're reading material, and that was a story I wrote in 2012. So what's crazy about it is that, you know, 4 years, your life can change pretty drastically.
Sure.
And so when I was in therapy and when I was, you know, I was in for about 2.5 years and dealing with all that, Low was a place that I was sort of taking all of those lessons and kind of morphing them into, you know, finding analogies and ways to kind of make stories with them. And it was a wonderful exercise. And I realized, so I wrote the 15 issues that are out now. I wrote that outline in 2012, 2013, and then we started it in 2013. Same year we started Tokyo Ghost and Black Science and Deadly Class. It was a very busy year.
Yeah, man.
But the next arc is going to be a lot different because I'm, you know, I'm in a much happier, better place these days. So it doesn't, I don't really have a lot of that same angst or processing of ascending from a low depth to you know, bleed into those pages anymore. But it's good. You know, that's the fun of the books, is that the tonality can change and shift, and the stories, like life, can evolve and change.
Very cool, man. Well, let's talk about Seven from Eternity first.
Yeah, let's.
Tell me about it.
Let's do it. Well, Seven to Eternity is a book that Jerome and I have been developing for, you know, we've been talking about it for years. The idea, you know, we would look at the InCal, or you would look at any Mobius work or you know, Yoderowski, and you would see this sort of what appeared to be part intention and part free form imagination. And boy, it just seemed like fun. It just seemed like that's how you would make comic books. And we really wanted to do that. And so, of course, it can never be that simple. And as we developed it, we came up with this world called Zal and all of these strange fantasy elements. But then I think that the secret to doing any of this kind of world building is you always want to get a stage that excites you and allows for really exciting opportunities visually and story-wise. And then you want to go small and find a character with a very relatable story in that world. And the character in Seven to Eternity is Adam Ostadis. And he's a gentleman who is trapped between a rock and a hard place as he is forced to go confront the God of Whispers, who has taken over the land. And against the wishes of his father, who has recently perished. And for the sake of providing and protecting his family, he might have to make a compromise that his father died not to make. And so one of the things that I dug into when I was building this story, and you know, much like there's a lot being said in something like Lord of the Rings, but it's still a small story. It's still a story about a small cast of or hobbits and a wizard. but it's still a small story in terms of character and heart and relatability. And in the same way, when I was at that point in the story, I hit upon a really interesting concept, which is just compromise. And as I started writing down, I do these little writing exercises, and I started writing down, daily compromises, compromises of the last few years, compromises in the last 10 years. And compromise really it enthralled me as a concept, because it's the heart of choice in a lot of cases. Most choices end up being a compromise. Mm-hmm. And it defines character. And if you continue to lean into a choice to smoke cigarettes, then that'll have its consequences. Or if you continue to be a womanizer, or if you continue to be a workaholic, like all of these various things. And I like what's behind those choices is the reason that you're doing it. And a lot of the time that's a compromise. I smoke because I'm on a diet and I don't want to eat a cheeseburger. Okay. That's a compromise. But anyway, so that's the beating heart of what's underneath all of this is this idea. We've got a number of interesting choices ahead for our character, and he'll be defined as well as the world around him shaped by the degree to which he'll compromise. And so without giving away too much, that was kind of the inspiration.
It seems like a lot of your concepts are like that. That you start with the big stage and then try to find the individual story. Is that the case?
Thinking about it, Lo was that way. Lo, I kind of have the stage first. Black Science, dimension traveling, being hurtled through dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
Fear Agent wasn't. Fear Agent was Tony and I built this character. He did a design. And then I started writing about who he was. And then I think the outline for Fear Agent came sort of after the carry anyway, but yeah.
But Last Days of American Crime, again, kind of that's the societies that came first, maybe the macro.
The end of crime in America was the concept. And then you start going, okay, well, what crime's going to be over? What's the most interesting part of that? And you come up with an old grifter who's on his last leg, who's got one last chance to pull off a heist of a lifetime. And then you I invented Graham Brick. I don't think I was aware of it, but yeah, I think I do probably start world and then boil into character.
Okay. Well, that's part of why I love you, man. I mean, truly, that's some of the fun is the environments that you first create, and then you give us the human story, that obviously is the center. So.
Well, yeah. And it's clearly something I like doing because I it seems like I do it in every one of these books.
And you find the right artist for these things too. And, again, great to hear you and Jerome are back. That's terrific. Is this an ongoing or a finite series?
Right now, we've got about 13 issues or so outlined for this first story. The thing about a level of art that Jerome produces, and coupled with the painted beauty of Matt Hollingsworth, we've got two of the very best artists of all time in comic books working together on this, and the pages are just ridiculous. And Jerome doesn't cut a single corner. So, in terms of that first story. I think that right now I'm not writing out past that. We've already cooked up ideas for 3 years, 4 years worth of story. But in terms of committing it to writing it, I'm doing it much like Tokyo Ghost. It'll be longer than Tokyo Ghost, this first story. And then, we know the next chapter. So it really just comes down to it'll take us a year and a half to get through the story we've got, and at that point, if we're still thrilled and tickled, then we'll keep going. But I would imagine that we would, especially hearing the sort of enthusiasm from Jerome when we talk about these other ideas we've got.
That's cool. Well, and also I wonder because it seems to me that you always have a good sense of when to stop.
I try to. You don't want to drag it into the ground. I mean, it can be difficult sometimes because you fall in love with the characters.
Sure. Well, I just, and I think everyone, I think a bunch of the, I shouldn't say everyone, but a bunch of the Image creators are trying to figure out, that's the thing. I mean, everyone got spoiled with the old Vertigo template of 100 bullets or 70 issues of Scout. And it's like, I don't know if because of the ridiculously good, diverse comic book world, I don't know if these stories can you make it that long.
Yeah.
Every one of them. Because again, it's like, well, what's shiny and new? And stuff that was shiny and new and still is very good just doesn't seem as shiny and new next to the brand new thing.
That's interesting. And I think that's a problem.
Yeah.
Because people
yeah.
want long form stories, but you're right. So something like, you know, like Low or Black Science, fortunately, they sell incredibly well in trades. But the singles went from wherever they opened, you know, 40,000 copies and drifted down to where they're at like 15, 16,000 now.
Okay.
Which is still very healthy. And in terms of
sure.
their own, we're all doing fine on that. But we've done our best to ship those as close to clockwork as we can. You know, the line of books that we've been putting out, we are on point. We didn't drift. We didn't disappear for 8 months. We've been keeping them coming out. But the attrition, you know, very few books escape the attrition. Every one of the Image books, the most beloved to the sort of obscure, they're all seeing the same attrition. And it is a difficult balancing act because ultimately people want, when they get invested, they want long form. Like I did, you know, and I know that a lot of the fans I talk to, if their first question at the show is, how long will this go?
Yeah.
And I get it because it's like, you know, people who love Deadly Class or love Low, they'll go, how long? And I go, well, we've got 32 issues of Low outlined and, you know, I could do more or, you know, it's a great ending. It might be an ending. I've got ideas for more after that. But, you know, like the elephant there, you know, the reality is how, what are the singles going to be down to when we're another 17 issues ahead of where we're at right now?
Sure.
And, you know, it is the new shiny thing because everybody jumps over to the new number one. But I don't know. I don't know what the solution to that is. But it's definitely the attrition is something that we're all seeing. Fortunately, the trades balance more than balance it out because the people mm-hmm. who want that long form are also very willing to support the trade paperbacks. You know, it's not on their shoulders to deal with the harsh reality, which is if people don't buy the singles, we don't get to make the trades.
Right.
So it's a very difficult balancing act. It's a very difficult balancing act.
Yeah. Like I said, I mean, I'm it's kind of a circular question that I've been asking all of you, because you're all kind of hitting those, you know, past 30 point and certain books and stuff. And it's just like, yeah, well, you know, I mean, I like I said, I mean, I feel like Celia Norton, even, you know, as great as Revival is and stuff like that. It's like, you know, they're getting to 50 and it's like, yeah, you know, it's time. And they know it's time too.
Yeah. And I think that, like, look, the market is going to dictate that. One thing that we've discussed. So, like, for Black Science, we have that outlined up to issue 40 right now.
Okay.
And we're going to at least get to 40. You know, if the singles attrition, if people want the long form and they want those trades, you know, you can't put it on the reader to make it their responsibility. So one of the things we've discussed is getting ready for, we only get paid on the trades every 6 months.
Okay.
So that makes it a little bit difficult in terms of, you know, scheduling your life and your money when you only get a paycheck
sure.
every 6 months. Fortunately, the singles still make us, you know, more than our Marvel rates. But
great.
If the attrition continues, we've all got, just like we did on Fear Agent. Fear Agent, the attrition went down. It was, I think the last issue sold 3,200 copies. Basically,
okay.
If you can find a copy of Fear Agent 32, you know, you found the rarest variant ever. But we had made our minds up to finish the story. And we knew that eventually the paycheck might be 2 years from now when we put out the hardcovers, but we'll get there. And I think that that's the kind of long-term thinking that's mandatory to keep these going because, you know, let's say that the numbers on Black Science or Low or Deadly Class start dipping into like the 9,000s, 8,000s. That's going to make it really tight. That means we're no longer making even our Marvel DC rates. But the trade paperback is so healthy that I think that what we've done is, in talking to Mateo last week and Tokini and Wes and Jerome, we're all just going to structure this in a way where we can get to the point that at least we're outlined to, and that's another year, 2 years of work on some of these books.
Okay.
But everybody understands that if the attrition continues, we're going to have to balance it to where, you know, like live on the trade money, and you know, creator owned's not for everybody. There's not a check. I don't finish a script. I wrote Tokyo Ghost number one in 2013, and I didn't get paid on it until, you know, November, December of 2015. It takes a lot of planning in advance and working on things that you're not going to get a paycheck for a long time. But, you know, now that we're up and running on enough of them and have the trades coming in, we can all stay healthy.
And that's, you know, you're content with the balance of introducing the new stuff and maintaining the old stuff and everything? I wonder, because wasn't there before the last Fear Agent arc, and I know it took a while to finish the last Fear Agent arc as well, but you guys kind of took a break, didn't you? Like after Dark Horse, and maybe because of people like myself that were keep constantly asking you, hey, are you going to ever get back to Fear Agent? Are we going to see a wrap up? And you're like, yeah, eventually. I mean, do you maybe see that as a possibility with some of these stories currently?
I would prefer not to, because
sure.
obviously there was a year between one, you know, and Tony and I went off and we did Frankencastle and Venom.
Right.
And we were having a blast doing that stuff. And let's face it, Fear Agent just wasn't making anybody any money. I don't see the numbers going down to the point where we're at crucial zone. So the idea, unless there's some kind of seismic shift and people just stop reading the single issues, the idea right now is, you know, Lowe's got an outline that goes to 32. Black Science is going to 40 at least. Deadly Class, you know, I just can't see ending it. If I have to tie Wes up.
Good.
You know, and with the TV show in development, and now we've got big news, you know, like that ball moved further down the field last month.
Excellent.
So, you know, we've got Sony and we've got the Russo brothers and we've got Adam Targum from Banshee and Outcast. And now we've got another big piece coming up that we can announce soon. But not just because of the TV show, but that book I could just write forever. So really that's going to come down to when Wes is finally like, all right, dude, I'm out. But I think that we could imagine, you know, there'd be 40 or 50 issues of Deadly Class. And, you know, this Seven to Eternity that we're building, Zol, Jerome and I have a Bible that we could do, you know, 50, 60 comic books with. So a lot of it does come down to the single issue orders and your ability to schedule things where you're not beholden to those and you can live on the trades. And so if that means, anyway, to answer your question, I do not see us retreating to do Marvel and DC work and pausing the books out. We'll fight out to the end and keep the book shipping for the fans that are supporting it.
That's cool. Okay. Well, you mentioned Deadly Class. What is the status of the media stuff? I mean, has it found a platform yet?
It has. Yes.
You can't announce it yet.
Cannot. We are looking at some very cool things happening. And so we, you know, I've been working with my co-writer Miles Feldslot on the outline for the pilot. And we just got the notes back from the Russo brothers and Sony and did some rewrites. And so it's in motion, you know, like I tell everybody, the way I understand it is most networks will pick up and develop about 20 ideas a season. And then of those 20, I guess about 4 or 5, they'll order pilots for. And then of those 4 or 5 pilots, about 1 or 2 get a series order.
Sure.
So even where we're at, you know, we've still got 1 in 10 odds of seeing a series come. But man, going through the hurdles we've gone through to be at a point where we're looking at 1 in 10 odds with the kind of team we've got in place, I'm hoping that if we knock the pilot out of the park, that we'll at least get a pilot order out of it.
Yeah, it sounds like a great lineup of talent. Russo brothers, for people who don't recognize right away, the Captain America movies speak for themselves, and you could see from an action standpoint and even you know, some of the strategies and stuff a kinship to Deadly Class. So that makes sense. That's great, man. I know. And also, I only think if for whatever reasons it doesn't work, God forbid this time, because like you said, I do think they sound like the stars are aligned correctly. It seems to me that the more you write it and the more you show the legs that the concept can have of this hitman high school and moving on to the next class and stuff, that's, you know, this is, you know, Friday Night Lights meets, you know, Wise Guy or The Sopranos or something. You know, I mean,
that's interesting. Joe Russo brought up the Friday Night Lights aspect of it as something that we're moving towards one of the storylines. I think that look, I'm biased. Shit, I love it. It's everything I want to see in a show, and it's an authentic snapshot of the, you know, the era I grew up in.
Yep.
And the kind of
absolutely
the kind of teenage existence I experience. So for me, it's just a, you know, obviously I would love to see it translated, but we have a great team, and you know, Joe and Anthony's background doing shows like Arrested Development and Community help out with the cast and the comedy aspects and the action, obviously coming, you know, and from their Captain America and their Marvel work, you know, and as producers, their notes are great, and they've been wonderful. So yeah, you know, at this point, I'm not popping a cork. It's good and far down the field, and we got 1 in 10 odds of getting it through a goal.
That's awesome, man. Will you let me catch up through 21? Where is the book on the stands right now?
So 22 will ship, I believe, the third week of September. So it'll come out.
Oh God, we're coming up.
Coming up, yeah. And that's
wow.
The fun of that was sort of emulating the X-Men when the new class would come in and that kind of stuff.
That's cool.
So Wes designed a bunch of characters, and I took the characters and started writing backgrounds for them, and then he would sort of tweak them. It was a very organic development, and it's been a lot of fun to throw a new group of characters into this same piranha tank with, you know, the reader now knowing just how hardcore this place can be.
Well, I think he shocked a lot of people with the fates of Saya and Marcus, definitely. So,
well, there's more of that to come. I think
of course
there's a lot of it's fun. I mean, the balancing act on this is that I have all of these stories that I wanted to tell from when I was a misguided youth, and then, you know, just trying to pepper that stuff into an actual narrative and let myself kind of drift in and out of the sort of slice of life and then drift back into the overarching plots and things. But it was an experiment. I really thought this would be the book that would, you know, nobody would want. I knew Wes is one of the, you know, most underrated brilliant artists in comic books, and that he would be beloved. But given the strange soup I was making, I didn't know it would find an audience. But I'd say that the audience for Deadly Class is as passionate, if not more, than the Fear Agent audience. You know, I'd say that those are the two things that have the most, like, fervent, passionate audience of the things I've made.
Well, it doesn't surprise me. And I think we got about 15 years apart from each other. I forget. Something like that. I was in college when you, I think, you know, or really ending college, where I think you've got Deadly Class and everything. And as you say, this was your high school years. So even an old person like me can relate to it.
Nice. Hopefully not. You can't relate to it too much, John.
No. I remember. Vaguely.
Back when John was selling angel dust.
Yeah, a little more extreme, but the aesthetic is there. I like it. The Friday Night Lights thing really did hit me reading this, in terms of especially knowing that you're moving on to the next grade. Although, as you say, unanswered questions, like, for instance, whatever the hell Saya, you know, whispers into Marcus's ear. I swear I had that digitally. You gave it to me digitally. And I was expanding that panel so hard trying to read that thing. And finally I'm like, oh, no, he doesn't want me to read this. It's still a secret.
But you know what? Some people online figured it out.
Really? Because I'm like, it looks like it's kind of upside down. It's a little.
It looks like gibberish, but it's not. I don't know. I gave Ross the actual line, and then he did some distortion to it. And somebody Twittered at me, and they figured it out. So
that's fantastic.
If anybody wants to sleuth, the answer's out there.
Well, clearly not for my prescription, at least on my current classes.
No.
So there, and again, my age comes through. I can't read it. I don't know. Can you put it out with larger type?
We'll have to do it. We'll have to do it. Now that since we're all getting so old now, we'll have to start doing that. We'll make the digital comic books have the 15 point fonts just covering the artwork with giant text. We're like, oh, that's nice. I remember my dad used to have the closed captioning on for movies, and it drove me nuts. But, you know, as we get
old,
I understand.
Yeah, there you go, man. No, I'm telling you. I think that's Superman under those letters. I'm not sure anymore. Could be, could not be. I'm not sure.
All of a sudden, my dad is Jack Kirby.
Jeez. Well, dude, this is great, honestly. And I know a lot of people are very excited for Deadly Class to come back in a couple of weeks. So, nice going. It's very, very cool. And people, as I'm sure you're still getting people jumping in.
The trades are gangbusters, you know, and I think that's the upshot of the fight is you get, you know, we're on four trades and an oversized hardcover, and we're working on the fifth trade right now. You know, people, like I said, I firmly believe you look at the binge watching on Netflix, people want long form. They want to get into something, and once they're invested, they don't want to be taken out of it, you know. And I think I see that on TV, and I see that in people's, you know. I read somewhere that 90% of the music you listen to is music you've already listened to. You know, the introduction of the new is something that we take, you know, baby steps towards as humans. So, you know, we've got a lot of story here to tell, and we're gonna keep you know, doing our very best to get the book out.
Very nice, man. Very, very cool. And what about Black Science? How are things going? There's two different families: the family of Lo and the family in Black Science.
Yeah, and they're fairly different.
Sure.
You know, and I'm exploring sort of different things in them. Black Science is entering a period that the book had been going 100 miles an hour for so long that when I was beating up the middle part of the outline. There's a lot of character stuff I wanted to get to, and it's not so much physical danger as it is betrayals and, you know, broken hearts. And what's coming up in the book is a lot of things that we've been setting the board for. That'll be a whole lot of interesting character bits, and then those continue to build until they explode in what I hope is an unexpected fashion around issue 26, 27. And around issue 26. So around issue 26, we return to the fast crazy. But at this point, characters and dilemmas that hopefully the reader is a good bit more invested in. So Mateo and Marino have been, you know, hard at work. We're already working on issue 26. The book is every issue is stunning. Those guys it's such a treat to see what they deliver. And so, yeah, we've got that. We've got the Black Science sculpture coming out for Christmas, which
I just saw it on your Twitter feed, man. It looks fantastic.
Man, what a nightmare that has been to put that together.
How come?
It's a lot of work. It's a lot more work than I thought. I want a sculpture. And a fan had done a really wonderful 3D model that we used, and we bought it off of him, and then getting it prepped to actually make it, and then getting it made and getting the colors right and the paints and getting the facial expression right and designing the box and dealing with the price point. We got to a point where in order to sell this thing at a reasonable price, and it's two characters intertwined, it's intricate as hell. It's like, you know, 14 inches tall.
It's the first cover, isn't it?
It is. It's the trade. The first trade paperback.
Yeah.
And we realized in order to make any kind of profit, we were being told that sculptures like this go for $250. And we rolled it around and decided that, you know, we're only making 500 of them, and we're just going to charge $150 for it. And if we sell all 500, we break even, basically.
Okay.
It's not a great business plan.
What happened to the publishing master, man? Wait a minute. Yeah. It doesn't translate to statues, apparently.
Apparently not. Apparently it was statues. I go, well, you know, I just didn't – it just felt like $150 for this thing is a completely fair price. and that will blow them out this way. And the fans who have been supporting the book and are so passionate about it, they can get their hands on one of these things and have it in their office or their room. Whereas like doing it for 200 or 250, and then there's ways you can do variants and charge more for collectors. And I was like, you know, fuck all that. We're making 500 of them. They're limited. They're numbered. They're beautiful. I just got the final prototype back today and met with Nate, the guy helping me put this all together. And
is it Nate Powell or? I don't know why I thought Nate Powell was a statue guy, but he probably isn't.
No, it's a different Nate. This Nate is with a company called Squid Ink. It's Nate Mitchell, and he has a company called Squid Kids Inc.
Okay.
And he just worked with Skybound and Brian K. Vaughan to make the Lion Cat statue.
Oh, that's great.
And so I've been working with him and putting this thing together, and we're to the home stretch now. So I'm very excited to get that out. And you know, any fan listening, make sure you pre-order it because they're gonna go quick. But then the idea is if we can do this and the next time maybe not make it quite as expensive, I can make them for Deadly Class and Low and Tokyo Ghost and Seven to Eternity, and we can make a line of sculptures.
That's fantastic, man. That's really great. No, it's gorgeous. It's on Rick. He's got it pinned currently to his Twitter feed.
Yep.
So right there for you at Remender, if you will.
If you will.
So it's great, man. No, I was really impressed. And that's cool that you're making it reasonable and everything, because that's the thing. You know, as a regular consumer, I walk in and it's, wow, that's a great statue. $400. All right.
Right.
And I walk away.
And now that I've done it, I know why that costs so much. And the fact that this is two characters that are so, and Mateo's costume design is so intricate, and it's two characters intertwined standing on a giant rock structure. And you see now how it's all put together and the work that goes into making that work. And boy, I mean, it's a lot. So, the next ones we do will not be quite as difficult. We'll pick images for Deadly Class. I think we'll do something that'll probably use the first cover of the comic with Marcus and Saya back to back, and we'll find cool things that aren't quite so difficult to make. But yeah, man, it's been very gratifying, even though it's been hard work, to see the thing come together.
That's very cool. And Lo, you just wrapped up the third arc.
We just wrapped up the third arc, and Greg is taking a break to do some shows. He basically locked himself away for 2 years to make these 15 issues. Greg pours a lot of time into those pages. And so he was like, I need a little time to go out and see the world. And I was like, yes, go,
my son.
But he's been hard at work on issue 16, which he and I co-wrote together. And it's a standalone story that takes us back into the world and sets some new pieces up. And then we'll be off to the races. So I think that we'll relaunch on that in January or February. We'll be back with the fourth arc.
Okay.
And then and the tone changes and there's some new characters. And, you know, I'm excited to finally get to some of these ideas that have been percolating on this thing since 2013 when I was working on that first outline. It's crazy because you write an outline in a month and then you work on the outline for 5 years and those ideas just sit there, you know, and you know, they're kind of gnawing at you like, oh,
I was going to say, you get anxious. I'm sure.
Yeah. I'm like an eager child. If people are talking to me and fans want to talk about the story, it's like I'll start popping off with like, okay, and then issue 17, you know, that character's gonna this, and they're like, dude, I don't want to know that. And I'm like, yeah, but it's killing me.
I gotta tell someone.
Gotta tell.
Danny can only take so much.
Oh my god. Poor Danny. She had no idea what she was getting herself into, marrying me. 12 years of hearing this nerd drone on about his stories. And then this is going to happen, and no one's going to expect this, and then the blah, blah, blah. It's just, God, can we please just go out tonight and do something normal?
Do you ever think about doing each arc as its own new number one through five or six or however long it takes?
I think it's a cheat. I mean, I don't know.
Like, really? I understand. I get that. I can appreciate that. But by the same token, there's nothing more frustrating. If you trade things and you trade them with the subtitle of the arc, then everyone understands what, you know, the pace of a story. I mean, it's more of a big two problem. The amount of, I mean, they abuse the, obviously the every number one, but if they did it where, you know, they did it more like in the Dark Horse model where each arc, you know, does a 1 through 5 and then on to the next story. I just think it's easier just from a, you know, understanding where, you know, where to start and where to finish standpoint too.
It is, until you get into a situation where Hellboy had been going on for 8 years and you didn't know what order to read the trades in because they, you know, or the BPRD stuff wasn't numbered. And it just, for me, it's like, there's nothing quite as simple as like, if you see low number 18 and it's exciting and you think you want to buy low, then we gave you 170 pages or something in a 999 graphic.
True.
Go read the first trade and start. It's like, because, you know, honestly, we really do create these books, and this is something that we kind of said going back to when we were doing figuring out how to pitch these books back in the early days when we were at Image in 2004 and 5. They're very much like HBO series in that they are stories that connect to stories and move forward, and they have a beginning and a middle and an end. And so I guess renumbering, you know, Black Science, you know, every 5 or 6 issues, you're going to get a bump on issue 1, but I don't really know if I'm going to be able to give you a clean entry point every time I do that for 1. So it might say number 1 and I might sell an extra 5,000-10,000 copies. But that entry point might not actually be feasible to be honorable to a reader and say, this is actually a place you can start the story. It's like, you know, would you start The Wire in season 3?
I hear you. Yeah. Okay.
No, I'm not comparing my books to The Wire. I'm just,
no, I get what you're saying though. From a basic story standpoint,
from a format standpoint, it seems like, look, it's much cleaner and easier. And, you know, I think what happened for, you know, there's been plenty of books when I was an avid reader where, I would miss the book till it was on issue 15, and then I'd hear so much about it that I'd go buy the first trade, the second trade, the third trade, and then I'd be caught up and I'd start buying singles. And I think that, I don't know, it might be my own OCD.
No, I honestly do get what you're saying and everything. It makes sense. Well, tell me about Tokyo Ghost. I know you guys are stopping at 10 and I've only seen the headline, so I really haven't really delved into the story of why. So tell me why.
Well, that first story was always intended to be 10 issues. We knew Sean had 10 issues in him. And then the idea was to bring somebody else in and keep it going. So I've got the story written, and I've even got a couple of artists in mind. But I guess when I wrapped it, I needed a break. Sean was going to, you know, carry on and do covers, and we were going to just keep the thing going. And I got a great artist if I wanted to keep it going. But it felt like I hit a nice landing point. And as we were getting to that, look, I mean, there were long, long conversations with Sean and I trying to figure out, you know, if and when to relaunch and to, you know, come out with the next issue. And I think what we decided is just for right now that the ending is, we feel very, like, we feel like we stuck a landing. We told a beginning and a middle and an end of a story. We're very proud of the work. We're going to put out an oversized hardcover next year. And around that time, I'll revisit if I'm still itching to get back to Debbie's story as she heads out into the tech-free Americas.
Very cool. Yeah, I was wondering, and I know that you guys obviously 10 issues over, as you say, 3 years.
I mean, you know, you start developing one of these things. We started developing it in 2013. And we really got to work in 14, and then it came out in 15.
It's only been a year. Forgive me.
And so the first half, it started September of 15. But, you know, I mean, look, Sean put so much into those pages. They're.
Oh yeah.
You have to get that kind of a ramp up when you have that kind of artwork. You have to give the artist plenty of lead time. So I had written the first issue, I think, in the summer of 2014, after Sean and I had been literally developing it for a year. But the good news about that is that you've got such a huge wealth of ideas, and you know the characters and the world so well that when you get into writing it, you're not going in blind and kind of doing guesswork. You already know it all, and now it's just to pick the story and tell it.
Very cool. Are there any other projects beyond Deadly Class that are in any sort of media development currently?
There are, yeah. Nothing that's to a point that I can talk about. Okay. You know, we've got some stuff happening with Black Science that we're working on there, and Nightmare has some stuff that we're working on. And
great, yeah. Funny.
Yeah, and then Fear Agent has some, you know.
Still?
Still, I'm going to knock on wood, but there has been some really great news in the last couple of weeks on that.
Oh, awesome, man.
Or a couple weeks, I guess a couple months. But anyway, you know how these things go.
I do. And I should ask you, and certainly I'm sure it was sad, although the man lived an incredible life. We've talked about it before, your guy's involvement with Jack Davis, yeah, in Fear Agent, and the fact that he did a variant cover, which is pretty amazingly fantastic.
Dude.
But yeah, you know, I have to say, and from a very selfish standpoint, I didn't realize Jack Davis and I shared a birthday. So that was kind of cool because, unfortunately, it was me and Britney Spears, and I wasn't really crazy about
that. Yeah, Jack Davis is better.
I kind of think so, man. My God, I just heard Al Jaffe on Gilbert Gottfried's podcast.
Uh-huh.
And they were talking about Jack, actually. And it was, you know, a few months ago that they recorded it. But yeah, what a life, what a career. Oh. And beyond Mad Magazine, such an important part of pop culture in a lot of ways, from TV Guide to so many album covers and movie posters and things.
Yeah, I mean, just and one of the most talented people. I mean, his artwork ranged from he could do horror, he could do anything, and
satire, absolutely.
The caricatures, and he is one of the best. And you know what's interesting is when you talk about your love of 50s and 60s films that I've missed, I worry that, like, you know, I only knew about the EC guys. I grew up with Mad Magazine, and obviously there was plenty of Jack Davis there, and like you said, all the other various places you'd see him in pop culture. But the kids who, you know, were born after 90 and who don't have somebody to point them to the old Mad Magazines and the old EC comics, and you know, do the Jack Davises and the Al Williamsons of the world, do they disappear? Is it just old guys, you know, like remembering them? And I guess at this point it would be the last for them would be Generation X. We were the last people exposed to all the Frazetta and Williamson.
Yeah.
And so my generation would be the last generation exposed to those guys. Is that it? You know, do you think that there's a whole—
I don't think so, man. You know, Rob Burnett and I were having this conversation either this summer or last summer because, you know, he's such a big fan of really old, you know, sci-fi, even going back to like the Flash Gordon stuff from the 30s and, you know, Buck Rogers and the like. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, there's always like a Tarantino sort of hipster that will find this stuff and translate it to a young audience and say, no, these influences are cool. You need to be aware of this stuff. And I do think that they're, you know, I mean, and that's where you guys even come in, you and Tony, certainly for Fear Agent. That's the thing. I really do think there's always a follow through. And thankfully, there are young creators that find these things interesting, reinterpret them for themselves and then to a new audience. So, no, I think, you know, as long as everybody knows where the influences come from. And I think everyone is that does that is cool enough to step back and say, Jesus, you know, you got to see the Shaw Brothers movies if you think cool. You know, today's kung fu movies are great.
Right.
Shit like that, you know. So I really think that's kind of the deal.
Yeah.
You know,
I hope you're right. I do. And yeah, I see what you're saying, you know, that, you know, some kid working at a comic book shop is going to dig through and find that stuff, or the old guy at the shop is going to go like, oh, you know, cause that's what happened to me. I mean, I started working at a comic store in 92. You know, it was the heyday of the original Image, and Valiant was huge, and everybody was, you know, obsessively collecting, you know, first appearances and nonsense. And the owner of the shop, Blake, sat me down and he was like, you like art and you like reading, right? And I was like, yeah. He's like, do you feel satisfied with these books? And I was like, no, I don't.
Go on.
I feel like, you know, there was a movement after, you know, like, there were so many great Marvel writers, and there was, you know, so many great cartoonists like Frank Miller and Williamson and people who could write and draw. And then it seemed like by 92, you know, Vertigo was a good place to go hide, and Fantagraphics had a lot of good stuff. And but yeah, I was like, nah, and he goes, here. And he just started digging through a bunch of just ratty ass old ECs. And he's like, in you know, giving me the history lessons and telling, you know, this one was written by, you know, Ray Bradbury, and just sort of walking through all that stuff. So, you know, and that definitely informed why I wanted to make Fear Agent and Black Science, and you know, the heavy metal magazines that I sat there reading, and the 7-Eleven, and heavily informed Low. So anyway, yeah, you're right.
That's cool. That's very cool. The, you know, I just had Bill Shelley on, who I talked to him about his Otto Binder biography, but he also just did one on Harvey Kurtzman. Mm. That is this like telephone book size book that I'm still plowing through. He won the Eisner for it this year. Dennis Kitchen just put out Kurtzman's Trump, not to be confused with Donald Trump, but Trump Magazine, the two issues that he did for Hugh Hefner after leaving Mad Magazine. I've never seen them before, but it's, you know, I got the preview PDF, and oh my God, I mean, if, you know, it's great, and it, you forget the power of Mad and Trump, obviously emulating Mad, that kind of pop culture cartooning that was going on in the 50s. And that's the thing, man. I mean, God, I only remember the 70s of Mad, which was still a vital Mad, but not the way it was in the 50s.
It wasn't Wally Wood and Will Elder. And,
right.
You know, yeah.
You know, I mean, that's the thing, man. No, and I mean, there were a few of the old guys around, like Dave Berg, and certainly Albert, you know, Al, help me. I forget now. Oh, God damn it. The guy, unfortunately, that Gaines picked over Harvey. Al, God bless
him. I can't remember.
You know who I'm talking
about. Yeah. No, once you couldn't remember, you made my...
Feldman.
Yes. There you go.
God, thank God. But that's the thing. I mean, yeah, Feldman was still around. And I mean, you know, certainly Don Martin and Sergio obviously was in his prime in the 70s.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. You know, it's really, you go back and it's like, no, this was really slick, really smart, well-drawn, you know, humor and satire.
And then when they went off to Playboy to do Little Annie Fanny, I mean.
Exactly.
Look at the craft of that stuff. Will Elder and Frank Frazetta, get the fuck out of here. Nobody.
Hey, amen, son. Well, you know what's interesting? I was telling, I you know, they kind of cop to it. But like Palmiotti and Amanda with Harley Quinn, I'm like, you guys are doing Little Annie Fanny. That's what you're doing.
Oh, yeah. I am so out of reading mainstream comics these days. I have not picked it up, but I'm a big fan of both of them.
Well, and that's the thing. I don't say that in terms of got you and, you know, make sure you're paying to the estates of Elder and Frazetta.
Yeah, like we were clearly, you know, bathing in Wally Wood and Will Eisner's spirit and space when we made Fear Agent.
Yep. Absolutely. Well, that's the thing, and that's what they're doing. Harley is its own thing, but there's a through line. And Jimmy smiled. He knew what I was talking about.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the thing. I think that's the good news, is I think very smart people, we all get influenced by the things we consume, and then, you know, you guys take it a step further and make something new out of it. Yeah. So, that's great.
I will stop being worried that these things will be off the tapes.
What else? What have you been watching? What have you, if you've got time? I mean, Jesus, I know you're juggling a ton of projects, man.
I just watched, you know, that's when I talk about people wanting, you know, multiple volumes and to stay in something, I realized, like, I watched Narcos season 2 this week.
Oh, man, I got to catch up. Very good.
And it's really entertaining.
Yes.
It's really, really great crime stuff. And, you know, the historical, you know, the fact that a lot of this happened definitely helps. I like the true crime stuff. But I think that the model, that Netflix model, like once I'm in it, you lose, you know, it's like, I know that if we don't ship a comic on time, you're already asking people to wait 4 weeks between 22 page increments, right?
Yep.
If you make it 5 and 6 weeks, you're I mean, like, I can barely maintain my attention span. When you dole your show out to me a week at a time, I do love that we're getting away from that. You know, I just watched my wife and I love Catastrophe on Amazon. It's one of the smartest things I've seen.
Oh, I haven't seen that yet. I've got Amazon Prime.
Oh, it's such great writing, and Rob, I mean, the acting, both of them, it's lovely. I highly recommend it.
I love Man in the High Castle, of course. I'm a big fan of that.
Yeah, and I have not dug into that yet, so that's on my list next.
Well, there you go. I mean, isn't that the problem, Rick? I mean, there's just too much good TV right now.
There's too much good TV. There's too many good comics. And I also was thinking about that the other day in terms of it's changed the way we are. There's still the Game of Thrones where we all collectively watch it. You know, it's sort of the modern equivalent of what MASH was toward, you know.
Sure. No, you're right.
But we used to have as a society things that we all watched and all knew about and all had conversations about. And
yeah, water cooler shows. Yeah.
Sure. And lots of them. And because there was three networks and usually, you know, maybe three good shows, like the Twin Peaks of it all, you know, Twin Peaks comes up. And I don't know if we're, you know, I thought like, well, Mad Men, but no, I talk to like, you know, people all the time who don't even, and never, ever even watched Mad Men. Never even tried it. And I found out that the average viewership was just a million an episode. Like when I was watching Breaking Bad for the first season and it still wasn't being watched. And I was like, oh, yep. Breaking Bad, have you seen it? No one was watching. And I do, you know, the pro is you can kind of control your consumption when it's dumped on Netflix. The con is we're not all getting it the same way. It's like, hey, did you see the George Carlin special on HBO Sunday?
Don't tell me, I just DVR'd it. I haven't watched it yet.
Right. Yeah. So it's just interesting watching how these things, the convenience offers us so many opportunities in how we want to digest it. But beyond the convenience factor, we've also lost something in sort of in having the thing delivered at a time where everybody saw it and then sort of lived in a conversation about it. Anyway, I'm on a fucking tangent. I don't know what I'm talking about.
Well, but no, it is. It is part of how this stuff is being distributed. And it is interesting that alongside the binges of Amazon and Netflix and Hulu, we've got still the weekly network, you know, schedule. God, what drives me nuts. I don't mind waiting a week for a new show, especially with the fall season pretty much upon us and stuff. It's those hiatuses in mid-season.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh, fuck you. All right, we're going away for 6 weeks. Oh, fuck you.
Yeah, or when they make a season up, you know, like that last season of Breaking Bad where it's like,
yes.
Or Mad Men. We're okay, 7 months, back in 7 months.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like when I meet people that haven't seen Breaking Bad and they're binging it right now and they can just watch it from beginning to end, I'm like, I'm so jealous that they get immersed in this thing and stay immersed. Because by the time, you know, there's been a 7, 8 month, 9, 10 month gap, and I come back to the thing, I don't remember. I'm like, what was going on? I am raising kids and writing comics. I don't know.
Yeah, man. No, life gets in the – exactly, man. Life gets in the way. And again, that's kind of why I don't mind the weekly schedule, because it's like, all right, okay, that was good. And you're going to give me a minute at the beginning reminding me what happened last week. All right, that's fine. I'm okay with that. Did you watch the night of the HBO thing?
I did. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
I did too, man.
I thought that the close was I knew what they were going to do with the clothes. That was telegraphed, I think, a little bit. With the kid off, you know, buying the cocaine at the end, and you know, as a commentary on the fact of what the prison system is like and what it actually does to somebody who is, you know, in it while being innocent, and corrupting influences, and how if you want to create a criminal, there's no better way to do it. You know, you can take an innocent kid. And who you know, got wrapped up in something and is accused of a crime, and putting him through that system, what comes out the other end is going to be the exact thing you don't want on the streets, the exact thing you don't want to create in your culture. So it definitely left me thinking for a few days afterwards, like, what is the solution? You know, like, is it kindness and rehabilitation, but then you're dealing with a sociopath who drowned his grandmother? Like, and then you just go like, I'm just going to lock the door and watch TV and stay away from people.
Good plan.
That's literally where my brain went after like spending days going like, what is the solution? You know, like God, the death penalty is not right. You know, nobody doesn't commit a crime out of fear of it. It's immoral. And then, you know, it's revenge, which I understand. If somebody killed my wife, I would want. And then you start thinking about the prison systems are, you know, they've been privatized, they're for profit. Everything in this country is so sideways with this. We've got more people imprisoned in America than in the next, you know, 10 biggest developed countries combined. Why? What is the fucking problem? Why, you know, what is the violence addiction this country has? And then after just processing that for a day and a half, like, I just go, okay, you know, it's all fucked. I just lock the door and turn on a movie.
I understand. I totally understand. What can you do?
Hopefully somebody smarter than me is working on this as we speak.
Exactly. I'll be ordering pizza if you need me.
That's my goal. That's where I'm at in society. I'm the guy who will – I'll give you a comic book to read while you eat the pizza.
There you go.
I provide distraction from the harsh realities around you.
Well, sometimes we need these things. It's all right. It's okay. You're killing me, man. That's awesome. Dude, I'm always happy to talk to you. I'm trying to think. Is there anything we haven't – any base we haven't covered? We haven't climbed.
In terms of the current crop of books, I think we covered them. I've got hopefully people will go out and pick up Seven to Eternity. I've made an attempt to tell a very slow story. It's we've been writing it for a long time and picked over it to the point where every word on the page is just cream. There's no fat on it, but it's a slow character story that takes place in a strange fantasy world that we're tickled with making, and I can tell you, you're not going to find any better art than the Jerome Opeña and the Matt Hollingsworth team up there.
Attaboy. That's excellent. And it starts when?
I think the first issue comes out in 2 weeks.
Excellent. Fantastic. What are you doing? Are you done with conventions this year?
Yeah, New York invited me, and I'm regretting not going now. I got really burned out, and then, you know, during the Marvel years when I was being swarmed, it was just crazy.
Sure.
And I was getting the flu, and then I was coming home, and I was a week behind work, and, you know, the traditional, like, boo-hoo, the cons are hard story. But so this year I really pulled back and just spent the time that I would have gone to cons taking my kids on vacations.
Attaboy. Where'd you guys go?
We went to Kauai.
Nice.
That's where Danny and I had our honeymoon. And I used to go there as a Boy Scout to hike the Kalalau Trail.
Damn.
And then while we were there, about day four, I realized I felt more human than I had felt in years. I just finally had taken a real vacation with my kids. And I was sitting on a beach with some friends of ours went with us. And I just suddenly felt like, oh my God, this is what it's like not to be an anxiety-riddled workaholic nightmare mess. I hadn't checked Twitter in 4 days. I wasn't looking at my email. And I just turned to Danny and I said, book another trip in 4 weeks. And she was like, what? And I was like, yeah, just book it now before I get home and then convince myself I need to work. And so we booked another trip a month later and went back for another week.
Wow, that's great.
It was so needed. Yeah, it was so needed. So getting those 2 weeks with my kids and doing that family stuff was the cost of me not making it to conventions this year. But look, it's either going to go one of two ways, I figure. I'm going to take a little break from cons and just keep making my comics. And when I finally crawl out from under my rock and start making it back to shows, people are going to be really excited to see me again. Or they'll have forgotten entirely, and it'll be a total – and it'll be a real blunder that'll cost my career everything.
No. I missed – were you in San Diego?
I did San Diego. I was in and out. I was doing some meetings and promoting stuff, so I was only there for two and a half days.
Okay, because I think I saw you very, very briefly from a distance. And I'm like, oh yeah, I'll have to see Rick. And then, of course, you know,
it's San Diego. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Oh, please. Literally, as you know, a dozen people like that you see for 5 seconds, and that's the last time you see it.
Yeah. And you, where are you going to be tonight? Okay. Yeah. The height. Okay. Yeah. I'll see you there.
It's true.
It's true. And you know, I did Seattle. I haven't missed Seattle since 2005. I don't think. I just
wow.
Love that show.
It is a great show. I haven't been there in a couple of years, but I love that show.
Yeah. But, you know, this coming year, I think that the plan is to try and you know, the year before that, I went to Leeds and did Thought Bubble, which was one of the...
Fantastic. Wow.
So great. And I unfortunately had to miss Angoulême, which I had been invited to be a guest at. My dad was sick. And so missed Angoulême, missed a couple, like... we sell gangbusters in Paris, in France. We sell a lot of comics through Urban. Like a lot.
That's great. Well, you know, I can see that though. They, you know, they like their sci-fi and fantasy, but I can see Deadly Class doing really well there.
They all do. And so Urban, Francois at Urban, he's like my second publisher, and he's such a great guy and so thoughtful. And he has tried to get us to come out and do a tour of Paris, where he would set it up where we could just, you know, go around Paris for a week. And he set up Angoulême. And
wow,
I've missed out on the opportunities to go to Brazil and Spain and Germany, and I wasn't England. You know, I made Leeds happen. I was like, I'm gonna go do this one. But that's the crazy fucking thing, is that all these things that I wanted when I was young and struggling and building this line of books, the whole purpose was to, like, I'm gonna travel and see the world, and now I've got the opportunity to do that. And if I take a week away, you know, it kills me. I come back and my kids have grown a half an inch, and, you know, they're off in different classes and living a life. And it's, you know, you can't do it. And so it's more important to be here and be with them. But I'm going to try and start breaking it up where I can at least do like two or three a year starting next year.
That's cool. And dude, you're not the first family man that has said that. And I'm glad to hear that because, you know, that means it's working. And, you know, you're doing what you should be doing, and that's wonderful that you're getting joy out of it.
I am.
So that's,
yeah,
you know.
It's really centering.
Absolutely. No, you're doing – Ricky, you're doing good. Trust me.
Thanks, John.
From my 11-year standpoint, I think you're doing amazing. And honestly, I'm really, really glad. I just – honestly, that class of guys that you're part of that kind of stepped away from Marvel and DC when you did – and made this step back in your case, and in some cases a lot of you guys, kind of your second time around with Image, this is the right time. You've got that core audience that is willing to follow you, and you know, that just proves that they like you and the work that you do. It doesn't matter if it's an X-Man or you know, a Justice Leaguer or somebody like that, or an Avenger. So that's wonderful. That means, you know, you're winning the game, and that's terrific, because it's just freeing you guys up to really expand your concepts and go in directions that would be too, you know, it's too confining at DC and Marvel to really explore these things. So keep it up. Well done.
I appreciate that. I needed, I got my 11 year report card back from John, and I it's nice. I needed to hear that, you know.
Nah, it's all right, man. No, I'm glad to be ringside for all the good stuff that's happening. And seriously, man, whatever you're doing to keep your creative juices flowing, keep doing it, because the proof is there in the work. You're going in really interesting directions. The characterizations are very deep, and the concepts remain very, you know, I think new ideas or new spins on old ideas. So, you know, keep it up.
Thank you, John. I appreciate that.
Words of wisdom from Rick Remender. Man, it was great talking to him. And I'll tell you, we're not done. I know it's almost the end of September, but I've still got other episodes that I've got to get out to you before the end of the week here at Word Balloon. And, man, I can tell you, because they're in the can. Coming up next, we're going to be having a wonderful conversation with Jeff Lemire. Jeff is doing great work on things like Black Hammer and some other wonderful books, and I really can't wait to share that conversation with you. And then also a new comedy interview, and that's with Tony Hendra. Now, you may not know the name, but you're going to know the guy when I start rattling off the guy's credits. He was Ian Faith, Spinal Tap's manager in the film This Is Spinal Tap, the guy with the cricket bat. No sex and drugs for Ian. You know, I distinctly said, well, actually, that was the wife who said, I distinctly said, put Spinal Tap before Puppet Show. But, Tony was an editor at National Lampoon, worked on the National Lampoon comedy albums, did one of the great National Lampoon comedy album segments, a great John Lennon parody called Magical Misery Tour. And, man, I'm telling you, check that out on YouTube, just on the title alone. It's one of the funniest things that I think the National Lampoon guys ever did on record. They are back with a brand new album, 35 years since the last National Lampoon album. And Tony is a big part of that with his new comedy group, The Final Edition. We're going to go into details on that, a bit of Tony's history, things like working on Spinal Tap and working on the Lampoon Radio Hour in particular. But the guy was a wonderful editor and writer as well, and it would have to be to come up with these great comedy sketches that he did. And just what happened to audio satire? Because it was such a big deal when I was somebody growing up, and it's like, what happened to this wonderful format? Real great conversation with Tony Hendra coming up at the end of the week from Word Balloon. We're also going to celebrate International Podcast Day, and that's coming up on Friday. And I will tell you more details on that as we move ahead. But Lemire, Tony Hendra, International Podcast Day, that's how we're going to close out the month here at Word Balloon. Next week, I've got the New York Comic Con. I will be flying out Wednesday night to be there Thursday through Sunday. So if you're going to New York Comic Con and you see me screwing around in Artist Alley or walking around on the main floor or stuck in the New York-like crowd that shuffles very slowly from the main floor or some of the panel rooms back to Artist Alley, please say hello. Let me say hello back, and thank you for listening to Word Balloon. I look forward to seeing everybody, both audience and creators, and it's always a great time. It's just really ridiculously crowded. But I still manage to have fun, as I'm sure we all do. New York Comic Con next week, and more Word Balloons coming up in the days and weeks ahead, man. People keep getting back to me and saying, John, I want to talk. Can we talk next month? And it's my pleasure to do that and bring you these conversations each week here on Word Balloon. Today, brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. And I want to go over some great Rick Remender product that is waiting for you at InStock Trades. If you want to reach back for some great Rick Remender product at InStockTrades.com, you will not be disappointed, because you can get things like the Sea of Red collection. You can get Volume 1 for 42% off, just $5.21. Same goes with Volume 2, No Quarter for Sea of Red, 42% off, $6.95. How about Strange Girl, Volume 1, Girl Afraid, 42% off, $7.53. Volume 2, Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now, 42% off, $8.69. There was Doll and Creature. I remember that fine Rick Remender trade paperback. Volume 1, Everything Turns Gray. It is 42% off, $7.53. Let's keep going with some more of this classic Rick Remender product here at Word Balloon. Sorrow. That was Rick, Seth Peck, and Francesco Francavilla. I remember that fine book. 42% off, $7.53. You can get the days when Rick was writing Punisher War Journal, and you can reach back and get things like Volume 5, which was the Punisher's run during the Secret Invasion period. That hardcover is 50% off. It's just $9.99. You can get his encounter with Jigsaw. It's 18 issues. It was great. 45% off. And Howard Chaykin, by the way, doing the art on this, and Matt Fraction co-writing that story. Punisher War Journal, Volume 4, Jigsaw, is only $9.34. How about Crawl Space, Trade Paperback, Volume 1, and XXX Zombies? A great story from Rick Remender, Tony Moore, and Kieran Dwyer. That is 42% off, just $7.53. We got the N-League. I remember that wonderful series. Kind of the superheroes in an Armageddon kind of situation. You can get Volume 2 of the N-League, Weathered Statues, with Rick and Eric Canetti and Andy McDonald, 45% off, $9.34. You can get the Sea of Red Slipcase Collection, which is a great pirate book with a lot of horror in there as well, 42% off. Rick Remender and Kieran Dwyer again, $23.19. There's a lot of Rick Remender product at InStockTrades.com that is waiting for you at great value prices. InStockTrades.com. Thanks again for listening to Word Balloon, and looking forward to talking to you more this week with great conversation in the Word Balloon tradition. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2016.